Hi, I'm Pete Kroll, and this is Dollars and Change, the expert's guide to sustainable, responsible, and impact investing. And I am here today at the ESG for Impact conference out right between Denver and Boulder, Colorado, with my friend George Gay, who is the CEO of First Affirmative, which is a sustainable, responsible investing firm that's been around for a long time. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm excited. I was excited when we set this up. Excited to be out here in Colorado, which you live out here.
Yeah.
And
it's a beautiful day here too. There we go.
The sun is shining out here to our left. So I want to start out and talk a little bit about, you know, how you got to this point. We both grew up on Great Lakes. We both had a background of understanding all the pollution and issues that came along with that. Tell me about your story.
Yeah, well, I grew up on the shore of Lake Erie on the western side, and just south of Detroit a little ways. And my story is that I just remember that when we went in the lake, you know, one of the things we were told was never put your face in the water. So when I learned to swim, I still to this day, I can't swim and put my face in the water. Wow. Because of the pollution, the water was dirty. I grew up in the 50s there. And basically we had carp and we had garpike and we had
not fish that you want to
not
eat.
Not fish that you would catch, not no. Fish. And of course, fortunately, it's gotten much better. Yep. and everything. But I was on a family farm. And so we had, of course, at those times, we had pheasants, we had muskrats, we had all kind of animals. And my dad was a conservationist, not an environmentalist.
Gotcha.
But you know, I learned a great appreciation for animals, environment, all that kind of thing as I was growing up.
And so, you know, to take that step forward to First Affirmative and everything you've done in the sustainable and social responsible world, you know, how did you make that leap?
Well, I did go to West Point. I graduated. I spent 9 years on active duty. I spent the last. And then I was 3 years more as a civilian employee at Fort Carson. So I spent my last 6 years before I came to First Affirmative on the community side of an Army post.
Okay.
So basically, I was responsible for the budgets for all of the businesses on the post to range from childcare and alcohol
service
and drug prevention
and like
all the way to the bowling alley and the golf course. So I learned business management from them. While I was still there, I read an article in Time magazine about the College for Financial Planning. Mm-hmm. And so I started the CFP program. And then when I decided to leave government service, I was looking for a place where I could work and found the guy who started the company that became First Affirmative and went to work with him.
Great.
And so that was in 1986, and I've been there ever since.
Well, 1986, we were doing socially responsible investing, and you know that when I started our firm in 2004, it still was socially responsible investing. So you know, you and I have had we've seen a lot of evolution over the years.
Yeah.
Talk about that evolution.
Yeah, I was, we started doing SRI in 1988. And we hosted our first conference in 1990. And I was on the board of the Social Investment Forum, mm-hmm. which is now yep. known as USCIF. And we would have conversations all the time about language. Because people would say, well, socially responsible investing, there's an issue there where you're implying everybody else is irresponsible.
Right.
Or, you know, so we were trying to find a way to brand the business and identify. And, you know, there were other names that were used. There was impact investing, there was sustainable investing, there was ethical investing. But none of that was really resonating.
Mm-hmm.
And so 2006, maybe, Rockefeller Foundation came up with the term of ESG, for environmental, social, and governance. And we thought this is one that will work. And it started to work, especially with institutional investors, and over time became, you know, in much more common usage. And then, of course, 2 years ago, it became political.
Right.
And, you know, here we are today.
Yeah, and that's where I want to go next. I mean, you know, we take a look at this, you know, anti-ESG, this woke investing pushback. And my opinions are well known on this, but I want to talk to you a little bit about that. You know, how do you see this for our industry? You know, is it positive? Is it negative? Is it affecting us? And what do we do to counter it? How do we deal with it?
Well, I would say that my first opinion has been, I like the term of ESG, but I don't like the term of ESG investing.
Yes.
Because ESG for me is due diligence. It's data evaluation.
Yeah.
And in order to turn it into investing, you have to have a value set. And so your value set then takes the ESG information and informs the investment decisions that you make.
Right.
And so if you're, you know, you can use ESG data for faith-based investing. You can use ESG data for conservative investing. You can use ESG data. And so the idea that ESG data of itself is problematic makes no sense to me.
Right.
And it's, you know, if you say, give me ESG data as to what is the best run coal company, you can do that. But
exactly.
The decision as to whether you should invest in a coal company doesn't come from the ESG data. It comes from something else.
Yeah.
So that's where we are, I think. And of course, what we're seeing is, we have a session on compliance at this year's conference, because we have now two states that require us as advisors to notify clients that we use ESG data, and that might be a bad thing for them.
Right.
And
you know, my argument for this has been, you know, we're fiduciaries, right? What's the most important thing a fiduciary can do? Have as much information as possible.
And evaluate risk.
And evaluate the risk. Evaluate the opportunities. Now, ESG is mostly about risk. It's less about opportunities than it is risk.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's. I would argue that if you're not using it, you're not within your fiduciary duty.
I think that most people who approach it as you and I do very much feel that way.
Yeah.
And of course, there are some court cases beginning about fiduciary duty and retirement plans and ESG, and it'll be interesting to see how those play out. But yes, I mean, as I said before, I believe that ESG data is due diligence.
Agreed. Yeah.
And
I call it enhanced due diligence.
Yes.
It's really just enhanced. So I've been quoted once or twice about, you know, talking about ESG and being sort of the Wild West.
Mm.
How do we sort of, because in one of the presentations that I give, I show the different ESG rankings for Apple, and they are literally all over the board.
Yep.
How do we really narrow that down? Because that is where a lot of our criticism comes from, is, well, somebody is saying this company is an A and somebody is saying this company is a D. How do we do that?
That's a great question. I mean, I have seen papers written where they take multiple companies and then take the score, and you get kind of a random distribution of data points.
Yeah.
And, you know, so to say, for example, with Apple, is their supply chain more important or less important than their human relations policies?
Right.
And so that in a scoring system where there is a different weighting of the different things. Another thing that happens with it is that big companies take the time and effort to respond to ESG inquiries. As you go down the slope, Smaller companies don't have the resources. Yep. So a very well-run small company just may not report enough to get a good score.
We see that all the time. We always have to put, when we're doing our Green Sage portfolio, we always have to look at the smaller companies because they're getting much worse scores, mm-hmm. even though they might be making batteries, mm-hmm. you know, that are a tremendous positive, but they're not getting a good score because at the end of the day, they don't have the bandwidth to do.
They don't have the bandwidth to measure how much water they use or any number of things. Yeah. And so the combination of different companies having different levels of reporting, and then different systems saying we're going to weight these inputs differently.
Right.
One of the possibilities is SASB.
Right. Which is?
The Sustainable Accounting Standards Board.
Right.
And they've made some progress on this because the accounting standards will fall back into, you know, if we can have an accounting standards system that people report to, and then everybody uses the data at least with the same weighting, so that then you can say, as an investor, you can make that decision. I think supply chain issue is more important than this,
yep.
or carbon issues.
Just a level playing field for the data. And then the second side, the opposite side of that is the black box that we see for the different ratings agencies.
Right.
We have no idea, for the most part, what they put into that and how they come up with their A rating or Four Globe rating or whatever it is. Yeah.
Right. And, we've seen that, we've seen that even with portfolio managers where the algorithms are proprietary, yep. and they don't want to share it with you, and you're just supposed to
trust us.
Trust that their algorithms work.
Yeah.
And so that is a valid criticism where people say, These things are all different. And at the same time, if you go back to the value side and say that all the values there's no way all people's values are going to be the same.
Absolutely. And so like for us, we do sustainable investing. That's what we do. We're trying to build solutions-based portfolios. So that's our values. That's what people come to us for. Doesn't make the other ways of doing it wrong. It just means that that's how we do it. And I think for any firm to just simply say, here's how we're going to do it. If you want to use us, great. If you don't, there might be somebody else who's going to do it a little
better. Well, I think the biggest thing that is changing is the capacity of technology now to work more specifically with an individual client's value set and process, so that in older days, at some point you always ended up where a portfolio manager had to make decisions of these are the things that we're support, these are the things that we're going to avoid. Mm-hmm. And so when a client came to you and said, these are my values, you tried to match them up, but it was still the best you could do.
Right.
And there's going to be some things they didn't like, but, better not be perfect. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But now we're to the point where it is more possible to customize a portfolio based on clients' values. Though the other thing that's happened is that people have come to believe that almost anything can be considered in portfolio construction. And it's the interesting thing. We spent 20 years trying to convince people that social screens didn't have a material impact on performance. Mm-hmm. And that was true in that structure of mutual funds and things like that. However, there is a point at which too many screens does have an effect on portfolio construction. And so then you get to the other side that says you have 50 things that you're concerned about, and we can't be certain as advisors that it's we can build the same quality of portfolio for you as somebody with 20 screens.
And that's about that, you know, that's about transparency then and being, you know, honest about that. I know Jeremy Grantham's team did some studies a few years back on not necessarily on social impact, but if you extract any particular sector on the market, and if you took energy out, if you took the oil sector out, it actually gave you a better return in his in his study. But when you started to take out more than two different sectors, that's when you started to see performance.
We've seen exactly that.
Yeah,
and you know, basically, what happens is you start to lose so many of the large cap companies.
Yep.
That you go to a small mid-cap bias, which is a different risk characteristic than large cap.
Much more volatility.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to shift gears a little bit here. You know, obviously, you've been in the business for a long time. And earlier we talked about, before we sat down here for the interview, we talked a little bit about how do we get other advisors, you know, who might be more traditional advisors, interested in integrating sustainable or ESG into their practices. How would you talk to somebody who's got a traditional practice, and what would you say to them?
I think that's an excellent question. I think there's two pieces to it. One is going to be demographics and age. Everything I've seen indicates that younger people have a higher level of interest in sustainability and ethical business practices and things like that. So younger advisors are probably going to be more willing to take a look at that, to just be able to meet the needs of that group. I think the other thing is that the adding values to the conversation with a client is without judging their values.
Right.
Where you have to respect where the client, you meet the client where he or she is, and you respect them for being at that place.
Right.
And then you can have a conversation about their values that says, you know, how would you like to use your money to teach your children your family values?
Right.
We've seen that. And it causes you to have a better connection, a longer term relationship with people when you've had that conversation.
Absolutely.
So I think it adds, you know, we used to say, you know, as a CFP, you had, you know, six things that you needed to know.
Right.
To be a CFP. And so to add values to, you don't give up any of those six things, but to add values to that conversation helps create a better relationship with the client.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's more important now than it's ever been to really look at this from a multi-generational perspective, because we've got trillions of dollars that are going to be handed down over the next 10, 15 years of the great wealth transfer. And any advisor who is saying, no, I'm not interested in sustainable investing, in integrating ESG, is probably going to get left behind.
I would agree. I think that if you're going to get into a conversation with that next, I mean, the thing that is a big problem for advisors, generally speaking, in a couple, the husband dies first, the wife picks a new advisor. The wife passes on, the children pick another different advisor. So how do you create a relationship that comes across those transfers?
Absolutely.
And if you're not in a position to have a conversation with the next generation and get to know them, get to know what they care about, the likelihood is that they'll find somebody who does.
Yeah, the Ernst & Young statistic is 60 to 70% of generational transfer goes to a different advisor.
Yeah.
That's just crazy to me. Mm-hmm. But that just means that we're not communicating well and we're not trying to reach out and make that connection with that next generation.
Yeah, I agree.
So there's one question that I have asked everybody so far that I've interviewed for this. And so this is our last question. So we see a lot of things negatively that are happening in the news constantly, from more intense and powerful hurricanes that are even hitting New England and California now, fires, droughts, all these things. In the light of all these things that are happening, how do you maintain hope?
Well, that's a great question, and. If we go back to 9/11 and say, okay, the country came together for a period of time after 9/11, or even to go farther back, we'll go to the moon in this decade. Mm-hmm. We would do not because it's easy, but because it's hard.
Right.
What I hope to see is a next generation of political leadership that goes back into the concept of being a leader. Again, I studied leadership, obviously, at West Point. And we have a lot of people right now are anti-leaders.
Yep.
And they deal in fear and they deal in lies. And so to see the hope is that some next generation of leaders can come in and say, these are our goals.
Right.
And we need to work together to solve these problems. And, that people don't deny that there are problems. I mean, at some point, we had fires from Lahaina to Rhodes. Again, if you've never been to Rhodes, one of the most beautiful islands I've ever seen, mm-hmm. and practically burned down entirely. Yeah. So to agree this is a problem and we have to work together to solve it. That's the hope that I have. That people just say that we can't tolerate some of this other stuff anymore. That's, it's a long shot. But
we're stronger together than we are apart.
Absolutely.
At the end of the day. George Gay, thank you so much for your time today. I always enjoy hanging out with you
and
chatting.
Well, thank you for being here. Appreciate it. And thank you for inviting me to podcast.
Absolutely. And thank you for joining us. Have a great day.
Take care.